Hello and welcome to Talking Africa. My name is Oheniba Ama Intiose and I have a special edition for you today. We are trailing the Africa Reports podcast series on women who lead, profiling high-achieving female business executives, politicians, and thinkers in Africa and in the diaspora. In each episode, we sit down with outstanding women and dive underneath the surface to bring you the most captivating personal stories from their journeys to the top, while drawing from their experience to empower the next generation of women leaders. My guest today is a top South African business person and a women's rights activist. She's the executive chairperson of Kalagadi Manganese and one of a handful of women shaking up South Africa's mining industry. A warm welcome to you, Ms. Daphne Mashile Nkosi.
Thank you.
We'd like to get to know you as a person. Who you are, where did you grow up, where is home for you, and you know, some family background, just so that people can know you a bit more.
Okay. As you say, my name is Daphne Mashile Nkosi. I was born in a town in the eastern Transvaal or eastern part of South Africa, in a town called Pilgrim's Rest, where gold was discovered in 1860. Mm. So mining has always been in my blood. I was born into mining. Mm. I was born there, but my family moved. My parents moved into Johannesburg because Johannesburg was the city of gold, where if you wanted opportunities, you'd move to the urban centers so that you can actually work for your children. Mm. So I was born in the eastern part of South Africa. Mm. As a young child, I used to walk 8 miles to school without shoes.
Wow.
And I think everything that you see about me, I was shaped by that environment. Mm. My grandfather was working in the mines. Mm. My parents, my father was we had a standard six. My mother never went to school, but she was a seamstress because with children, you know, 4 children to feed, 4 children to look after. As a mommy, you have to learn to do other things. Sew for your little girls and your little boys.
Mm.
Yeah.
So
they never went to school. So I was not born of a teacher or a nurse. I was born of just ordinary people.
Mm. But look where you are today. I think there's nothing ordinary about your journey so far. So tell us a bit about the young Daphne. What was she like?
I think the young Daphne, as I say, I was shaped by the environment. Mm. I saw poverty every day in my face. I have slept without food simply because there was no food for everyone. Mm. And simply because of that, somewhere in my subconscious, as I was growing up, I decided that my children will never go through that. So the young Daphne, I remember in Standard 1, I actually wrote... My teacher used to remind me that when I was asked, what do you want to become? I said, I wanted, you know, to be successful. I wanted to build a big house. I wanted to get married. I wanted freedom because South Africa of the time was very, very difficult. There was no freedom. So those were the 4 things that I wanted in life. And actually, it is those things that as I was growing up, I wanted to achieve each and every one of them. Mm. I, for instance, freedom. I fought for freedom. I was class of 76 at the Soweto uprisings. I was part of the Soweto Student Representative Council. So I wanted freedom. Mm. In terms of building a big house, I wanted to be economically independent so that I can have the things that I have. I wanted to deal with issues of poverty simply because I've seen poverty, you know, I've experienced poverty, and I never wanted my children to go through that. Happiness, of course, you wanted to get married as any young girl would want to do, but I was always an outlier, always a go-getter, always want to do good, always wanted to be the best of the best.
Yeah. Very driven then as a very young girl, and I know that laid the foundation for all that you achieved afterwards. You mentioned your political activism.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us a bit about that and how that led you into the mining industry?
I think when I was in matric, there was the Soweto uprisings in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the executive who organized the marches and everything. Mm. And of course, you end up in prison.
Mm.
I was in prison. as a student.
For how long?
In and out, 3 months, come back, 6 months, come back, 9 months, come back. And for me, it was a story of my young life. I met my husband, who spent 12 years in prison because we're all activists. And my son was actually 12 when he met his father for the first time. And it's all those things that, you know, actually shaped me who I was, because I was a go-getter. But also the survival strategies that I had in business were actually shaped by the fact that I had to survive during those days. As an a student activist, I wanted education to be equal. I wanted equality before the law. I wanted everything that everyone could achieve in South Africa. And therefore, it actually shaped me to become a woman activist. So I'm a woman activist because as a student, I was an activist. And therefore, what did I do as a woman activist? I became, you know, fought for the minority of African women under customary law, or what in South Africa we used to call the minority status of African women under customary law. And I actually influenced policy with the new government in 1994 to actually have the equality law, which actually looked at both the traditional marriages that were impacting negatively on women, to say, what is it that can be done? It was about the choices that we make as women. If you want to be in a polygamous marriage, so be it, because we have the right to do so. But you must be protected in terms of how you bring up your children, how you accumulate wealth, because if you don't have wealth, if you don't have land, even in South Africa, even in Africa, it is so that if you don't have land, you don't have collateral, and therefore you cannot get funding to actually improve yourself. So it's all those things that actually shaped me as a young woman activist. I was part of the pre-Beijing process in Dakar in 1985 and the post-Beijing process. So I've always been in the empowerment of women in all my life until I became a mother, I became a grandmother. So I'm still on that journey up until today. I'm in business. I advocate for the inclusion of women in businesses.
Wonderful. Well, before we go a bit into your industry, since you brought up your women activism, I think we want to go into some gender questions. Like, you are in a very male-dominated field. I think that's obvious in the mining industry. And some top female leaders have said it can get very lonely at the top, where you really feel you can't, you know, sometimes you just want a woman to talk to because they understand how you feel. Sometimes you look around and there's no one. How have you dealt with this? Are you pulling other women up so that it's less lonely at the top?
Pulling other women is one. You're pulling them up so that you can mentor them, so that you can talk to them, so that you can, you know, share the challenges, share your frustrations, share your failures, because we never actually share our failures. I've done that, but it actually is very lonely. As I said and indicated, that I was always an outlier. At home, I was the only one who was asking questions. So being lonely for me actually was a driver to say, you know what, there's nothing wrong in me being the only one. There's nothing, the odd one out, for as long as I believe in my vision and focus on actually changing society by actually having a different point of view. That was my approach. The loneliness, I can tell you, so many times I wanted to throw in the towel. But I look back and I said, I've always wanted, being part of the Beijing process, was that we will work, you know, for the empowerment of women. And I actually said, if I fail, young women will fail. If I fail, young women will fail in Africa. If I fail, young women will fail elsewhere outside of Africa, in the whole global, you know, we are now part of the global village, and therefore everybody will know that I failed, and therefore I would have failed the whole world. And I didn't want to do that. So many times I've thrown in the towel, and to wake up the next morning and say, I can't do this. And let me push myself. And there were women who might not have been in the industry, but who actually saw my pain, who actually saw my efforts, who, those that you employ, those that know about you, those that see you as a role model. So those are the people that I stood in their shoulders to actually share some of the frustrations. Mm. And sometimes as women, we are harsh on ourselves because we never want to fail.
I wanted to talk to you about that.
Because failure is something that people see in women only. Mm. And for me, I was saying, yes, if I failed, it's fine. I'll stand up, I'll learn from it. And let me tell you, you fail, you look back, you say, I would have done it differently. And you dust yourself and you stand up and you do it much better. Mm. So
it's something I wanted to talk to you about, the pressure we put on ourselves as women. Because we have this standard of perfection we want to hit. And men don't put that pressure on themselves. I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong. But I feel as women, we really expect, you know, the expectations we have of ourselves sometimes is to a point where it's overwhelming and you don't even end up doing what you have to do.
I think I'm of the view that women don't have choices because we are expected to bring up children. You are expected to bring up these designer kids. You want them to succeed. You know, you designer want your boys. Kids. Yeah, you want your boys to succeed. You want your girls to succeed.
Yeah.
You want them to get married. You want them to be successful. Mm-hmm. So everything that you do, you want to cook for your husband. Mm-hmm. You want to be the best cook. Mm-hmm. You want to be the best wife. You want to be the best of everything. And therefore, that's the pressure that, unfortunately, mm-hmm. as women, we have to push ourselves. But also, if we are to compete mm-hmm. with males, you have to do it 10 times more for people to actually recognize that you can. For instance, when I started companies. I started the first coal company. People don't actually know that I was a founder of the fourth largest coal company in South Africa simply because they never saw me because I was an odd woman, you know, in a group of men. They actually saw the men who started the company and not you. And therefore, I had to put as much more effort in manganese for people to recognize that I exist as a female and I can do it on my own.
Wow. Since you brought up manganese, I want us to go back to the industry. So manganese represents 80%. South Africa has 80% of the world reserves, which is really significant. And you've said in the past that the commodity you believe it should be declared a strategic mineral resource in South Africa because of its importance to steelmaking, for example. Do you think this has been taken up seriously?
I think it's not only in South Africa. Mm. If you look at South Africa representing 80% of world reserves and Gabon and the West African countries, actually, there's a pipe, you know, of iron ore and manganese in West Africa that is coming down. It therefore means that between, you know, the African continent, we actually have 90% of world reserves of manganese, which manganese, without manganese, you will not have steel, which without steel, you will not have infrastructure development, you will not have the ports, you will not have the highways, you will not have the buildings, you will not have the ICCs that we are in an international conference center today. You would not have that without steel, and therefore, without manganese, all the raw materials are in Africa for steel making, and therefore, we need to beneficiate that and add value so that we create the jobs in Africa and never import them as raw materials to buy them back as finished products. Because as we do that, we actually export the jobs and our people become more unemployed and you create opportunities for other countries like China to actually import steel at very high prices, creating jobs for themselves. There's no country, there's no continent that will act in the best interest of another. For Africans, we need to ensure that we create jobs for our people and not export jobs. Because there's no one who will sit and say, you know what, Africa must actually develop.
Yeah.
It is us as Africans that will make Africa great.
And with this jobs being exported, I believe that has to do with the smelters, for example, being set up in Malaysia. That is taking away jobs from the local people in South Africa.
Of course, it's easy. And no one said it's easy. Mm. Everything is difficult. Mm. If electricity pricing in Africa and South Africa in particular is expensive, it does not necessarily mean that you can't have constructive engagement to try and come up with a solution. It becomes a business imperative to plan for it rather than export the jobs. It's an easier way of actually looking at it and saying, I'll go to Malaysia because they have hydro, you know, energy, and therefore they will give me a cheaper electricity. You don't look at the best interest of your own country, because yes, you have the smelters in Malaysia, but at the end of the day, your company is in South Africa. Your company is in Africa. For as long as Africans are unemployed, your company will not grow as well. There will be instability, the tsunami of the young unemployed graduates that we are actually generating every year in and out and not create the jobs will catch up with Africa. The fourth industrial revolution, the 2063 plan, or the Africa 50-50, we will not achieve until we as Africans become committed and own the development that we want.
And do you think the mining charter, for example, in South Africa is leading towards that, into owning what we can become?
I think the mining charter in South Africa, it has its own challenges. But from a black empowerment point of view, as a South African, it doesn't impact negatively.
Okay.
It's actually saying, let's localize. Let's ensure that as we mine, we create the environmental hazards. Let's plow back into the communities that we're working with. Let's create industries. Let's make sure that we do not leave the mining towns as ghost towns. Because if you look at how mining was done in South Africa, is a case in point, where you look at the Kimberley Hole, where diamonds were actually taken. Yes, we celebrate the Kimberley Hole as a tourist attraction, but it was an environmental hazard. It's an eyesore that people just took the gold during the gold rush of the 1800s, they actually opened the hole and left it there. They didn't care what will happen to the hole. So we are saying, let's be responsible. Let's love our country. Let's mine the resources, but also rehabilitate the land. Because if you rehabilitate the land, you can use it for agricultural purposes. Because there, in my view, there are two legs to empowerment and development in Africa. It's natural resources, because we have mining resources. We also have oil and gas. But also in agribusiness, because we have the land and we have the women that can actually do that. And we have vast pieces of land. And it's the only continent that has very fertile land that you can actually feed the whole of the world. The global community can eat from Africa.
Why are
we not doing that? Why are we always talking about the Asian tigers? Where are the African lions or the African elephants? We want them. In fact, it should be elephants, because when an elephant moves, you can feel it on the ground.
Where are the African elephants? We need to look for them and bring them on board.
And also, why are we not learning from the Asian tigers? Why are you not learning from China? China, in 1978, they didn't have the highways that they have today. They have 84,000 miles of highways that they started building. They have a 20-year, 25-year plan. They have a 50-year plan. They have a 100-year plan.
Yes.
To overtake the U.S., and they are going to overtake them.
Yes.
Where is our plan? As countries, as a continent, we no longer have an excuse. We have the African Union, we have the African Development Bank, we have resources, we have support, so we have to do it.
We have no excuse.
Do we have the political will to do it? Those that do not have the political will to do it, we as the electorate who elect them must remove them so that we get people who have the interest of the African people at heart.
You talk about the electorate, and it's linked to my next question on the government and what incentives can be put in place to spur development, especially in the mining industry. And also, if you are getting the support you need, because you're in an industry that needs funds, that needs investment, do you think the government is doing enough?
I think government is doing enough.
Okay.
But government is not focused in terms of where they would want, what is it that they want to achieve. We have so many legs of government or hands of government that actually don't know what the left or the right is doing. And I'll give an example. If you want to grow the economy in the mining sector, which is the backbone of the South African economy, you will look at what is it that the mining sector requires. In our case, for us to do downstream beneficiation, you need to add value into the resources that you are actually mining. Mm. And therefore, it means you need electricity, cheaper electricity. Because, by the way, you're competing in the international space, commodity pricing. You know, if you are going to be the highest cost producer, you are not going to compete. And therefore, from a government perspective, we need to create incentives that would support the mining sector. In my view, it's electricity, okay. It's water, it's legislation, it's regulatory. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to fast track and prioritize those so that they are conducive to mining investment in South Africa. Mm-hmm. So we are engaging with government to actually look at those incentives, and they have moved in terms of going to those strategic development zones where they would want you to go in there and, you know, put your plants there because there's incentives that you can actually tap on so that you become the lowest cost producer and compete, because our markets are not in Africa. Mm. Our markets are elsewhere, and therefore we need to compete in the international arena.
Okay, so engaging governments is definitely something.
Constructive engagement, constructive engagement, constructive engagement. I can never say it enough with our governments. Mm.
You often refer to as the Iron Lady, and I've always wanted to know what you think of that name. Is it something you love? Do you love to hear yourself being called the Iron Lady?
I don't care what I'm called. for as long as I make an impact in the lives of ordinary people. Okay. I've always been called names. I'll share a story. Mm. When I was growing up, I was an ugly duckling at home. I was an ugly duckling in class. The teachers, I could sing. Mm. You know, I had the best soprano.
Oh, definitely.
Of course. Wow. But the teacher will always say when we're going for competitions, she doesn't have the shoes because I came from a poor family. Yeah. My shoes were always torn. Mm. And they would make sure that they put me at the back. Because first of all, I was ugly. Secondly, I had torn shoes. You know, so when the judges are looking at people, they must look at those with the English nose, with long hair, you know, the pretty little ones. Oh. And I was, unfortunately, the ugly duckling. I could sing at the back. I could sing at the back. So I was always told how ugly I was, how was this and that. But I didn't care. But I knew that when I was in class, I was number one in class. Mm. So
that's the spirit of resilience.
You call me Iron Lady, you call me Teddy Bear, it's okay. For as long as I make an impact in the lives of ordinary people.
That's the most important thing. I love
that. The most important.
That's the most important thing. Well, you won CEO of the Year, the Africa CEO Forum in Geneva in 2014. And you talked about the mining industry, the fact that it's not been an easy road, especially for a black woman, how you've persevered and succeeded in surmounting the many obstacles that were placed in your path. You said where there's no pain, there's no gain. I think you shared a lot with us. As a leader, can you share with us maybe a day where, you know, your absolute, absolute worst day?
My absolute, absolute worst day was in 2011.
Okay.
I woke up, I went to the office as normal. Mm-hmm. I get an email, a call from the bank to say, we have four people that are actually saying they now own the business. They're here, you know, to transfer money that is in the bank account. My business was hijacked. They changed the registration papers of the business. Suddenly, within 5 minutes, I never owned the business. Eight people that I actually don't know were owning the business, and they were with the bankers at Absa trying to withdraw millions into a different account.
We're talking about Kalagadi Manganese. Here.
I'm talking about Kalagadi Manganese. It's well documented. I didn't know what to do. They had removed me as a director, and all the directors, they've actually put themselves there. Mm-hmm. And I had to go to court to prove that I am who I am and that Kalagadi was my business. That my worst nightmare. If I survive that, I can survive anything.
Wow. I'm sure you were furious.
furious is an understatement. I went to court. When I was told, sorry, ma'am, we don't even know who's who in the zoo, whether the hijackers are the real hijackers or whether you say you own, despite the fact that I was the founder of this business, I had still to go to court to prove that I am who I am. And I had to go on an agent basis. For a week, I was sitting with a cloud hanging over my head until I won it in court.
How long did it take?
It took about 7 days. I ended up, when we went to court, I was awarded. When we did a check on these people, who they are, I found 7 of the 8 were state president patients that were declared criminally insane, to make it worse. So I will write a book when I retire.
Please do.
Criminally insane, declared by doctors. And when they did what they did, they were given, you know, when you are a state president patient, you stay in a mental institution. So they were given a 2 weeks break to go home. And that's what they did. So my company was hijacked by mentally insane people. 7 of them declared. They are declared by the courts, by everybody, doctors. But they were coordinated by one person who knew what he was doing, because they actually got criminally insane people to be directors of my company.
That seems like I don't know how to feel about that. And that was in 2011.
Yeah.
Yes. And like you said, I think if you can survive that, you can survive
anything
else. And a proud moment.
My proud moment was when the first blast underground. Ooh. We've sunk a shaft. It's the most dangerous in the mining sector. Without killing people, we went underground. We're able to blast and produce manganese. And when I actually pressed the button for the dynamite to explode and give us manganese, that was the proudest moment.
I feel the excitement right now as you're sharing it. Well, back to the policy platform of the economic freedom fighters who are advocating the nationalization of mines. If you can just touch on that a bit, is that something you'd be open to?
I think people are misinterpreting the Freedom Charter. It says the land shall be owned by those who live and work it. It therefore means that if you have a piece of land, you must work it to produce food. It is a misinterpretation of facts, because people think that probably they'll go to Sentin and they'll be awarded the land in Sentin so that they can own the buildings. I don't subscribe to that. It will never happen, because we have a very good constitution that protects property rights. If people are going to be given land, it will be land that belongs to government for people to use it to produce food, for food security. Use it to build buildings so that you create opportunities for other people. If you are going to have people just that are going to, it would be worse than what Zimbabwe has gone through on the land issue. Because if you give people land without actually planning for it, that's the disaster that you are actually going to create by actually saying things. It's statements by people who are not tried and tested in terms of better understanding the issues that we are grappling with on a daily basis. The fact that, you know, as a people, you need to work for government to actually give you the services that you require and contribute to the tax base. So people don't have an appreciation of some of those. So I actually don't subscribe to that.
And talking about another proud moment, I suppose another one will be when you finally complete the newly put a plant. I want to believe that will be another very proud moment for you.
I've always wanted it to be a 4-in-1. But probably I'll do it as a 5-in-1. And I'll tell you why.
Yes.
We have the mine. We have the ore preparation plant. We have the sinter plant. It was going to be the smelter. We're looking at a solar plant.
Wow.
To deal with issues of electricity. We wanted to perfect the mine, the sinter plant, and the ore preparation plant. We are in production. We are exporting manganese. We're now looking at the smelter to produce high carbon ferromanganese and silico manganese, which are, you know, beneficiated products that are actually used in steel making. Steel mills are looking at silico manganese and high carbon ferromanganese, but also, you know, manganese for batteries and so on and so forth. So the opportunity is now. I'm ready. I've made all the mistakes. I am in production now. Wonderful. I can focus on the development of the smelter.
Wonderful.
Having said that, I'm also in the process of actually saying, what is it that I require in terms of making sure that I have the energy that I require, you know, so that I'm not at a risk of fluctuating energy costs. Building a 200 megawatt solar plant, because I'm in hot as hell. It's called hot as hell because it is indeed hot as hell. So I have the sun that God gave us. I have the land. I have the grid on site because I have a substation. And I can just put a solar panels to generate solar energy and put it into the national grid so that I can trade during the day with Eskom and actually reduce my energy costs so that I continue to become competitive in the global markets.
Okay. You mentioned beneficiation there, and I'd like to talk you to talk a bit about that and some of the issues surrounding that in South Africa.
We are driving beneficiation because we believe it's the right thing to do. Never would we actually continue, you know, Africa being, you know, taking all the raw materials to come back and buying them at huge amounts. I mean, like steel. All the materials that are actually making steel, whether it's platinum, whether it's chrome, whether it's manganese, are in Africa. But Africans don't actually have, they have very few steel mills. All the steel mills are in all the countries and continents where they actually don't have the raw materials. We have the raw materials. And for Africa to actually develop, we need to beneficiate and beneficiate our mineral resources, so that we actually beneficiate here and create the finished products and sell them elsewhere rather than actually import them at huge prices. So for me, I am, you know, punting and working harder on beneficiation. I am in the forefront of beneficiation and I will not sell an ounce of ore. I will explore all avenues to ensure that I beneficiate the products that I actually mine on the ground.
I believe there's nothing that's going to stop you.
Yeah.
Do you think as women, because I'm asking this question because sometimes I have the impression it's easier for men to show emotions, to lead with emotions. Women sometimes hold back because you don't want to get that narrative of you're too aggressive, you're too ambitious. I don't believe it's the case for you, but can you share some thoughts of that?
I think women, because of what we go through, we come with solutions. Emotions is important. I'm saying as women, we must be allowed to become human beings, to have feelings, to empathize, to sympathize. But at the same time, to try and resolve issues because that's our strength. We, on a daily basis, every day, our children, we want them to succeed. Our husbands, the household, we want them to eat well. So we are, by nature, you know, built to actually deal with issues. And therefore, we come with solutions. But at the same time, it does not necessarily mean that we are not human beings. We are not like anyone else. We have to show emotion if we feel like. But if we feel that you want to sympathize, want to empathize, want to cry with them, we can do so. And I know sometimes we actually feel that they will say I'm emotional because I'm female. Me, I'm an outlier. I do what I think is right for me, for as long as it will benefit those that I'm trying to help.
What leadership advice will you give to an aspiring female who looks up to you, who has seen Daphne who was poor, Daphne who went to bed without food, Daphne who didn't have shoes, but today Daphne who is all this conglomerate and is not stopping? How can I become like you?
If you believe in your dream, focus on it, work on it, get as much information that you can get. You are better than me because you have social media, you have Google, you have e-learning. Mm. You have platforms that we didn't have. Mm. You are female. We have the support. We have debates and discussions. We have those that have actually looked at financially exclusion of women, and they want to include women. The sky is the limit. Mm. You have the technical know-how. You have the education. So there's nothing that can actually stop you. Mm. Focus on it. Mm. Work on it. If you fail, do not stop. Stand up. Dust yourself, start all over again until you achieve your dream.
Until you achieve your dream.
You mentioned your husband. How important is it for spouses, for top women leaders like you, the support of your spouse?
My husband encouraged me when I was raising money. I didn't have money. Mm. And he was working. Okay. And he used to say, "You are a bottomless pit because we are taking from my table and for my children's, but I want to encourage you to continue." And he supported me big time. Unfortunately for him, he passed on in 2008, not to see what I've achieved, but he saw what I achieved, because when I sold the company for 4.2 billion, he was there to see it. So he's seen the achievements and the support. So I am who I am. I was allowed to do that as a married woman by my husband, who allowed me to be who I am. He didn't want to change me. And therefore, I'm going to encourage men not to be threatened by the success of their women, but encourage them because they are working for the betterment of the family and for society as well.
I think that's a very secure man who is not intimidated by a woman. And how do we raise these secure men?
We need to bring up boys of the future. It therefore means that boys of the future don't see you as a woman that must always be above you. See you as a human being, as a partner.
A partner, a team player.
A team player. Co-parenting.
Yes.
And therefore you'll see the growth of the family. Partnership.
Yes.
It's a partnership.
It's a partnership.
So I think we have a responsibility also as women to bring up young men of the future and young women of the future, and not young men and women of yesterday.
Our thanks to Daphne Mashile Nkosi, and thank you for listening to the Africa Report's Women Who Lead podcast. Be sure to connect with us at theafricareport.com. We are at The Africa Report on Twitter, and I am at @Oheneba_Ama. For the very latest news and analysis, do sign up to our newsletter. And if you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Until next time.